In seminary, I learned about the historical witness of believers throughout centuries. And I became aware of our modern perspective on how much we're indebted to those who came before us for what we're able to do today. When we tend to think, like we were talking about yesterday, how advanced we are now, there is a certain arrogance when we dismiss centuries of people and happenings and as if they're disconnected with where we are today. That one of the quotes, I can't remember where it's from, that was made was comparing us to standing on the shoulders of giants, that somehow the past enables us to have a clearer vision than we would have had otherwise. And the intent is to say that because of that possibility, we have a much greater potential now for doing and seeing than we would have had before. We can grow from that. I'm not always satisfied with that type of a, that's one form of a hierarchical image, when you're standing on the shoulders of other people. And sometimes that looks a little oppressive to me, as much as I understood the idea behind it. You know, I think of, you know, the pressure building up as you stand on top of others. But there are two other images I'd just like to share with you before we look a little bit at history, or her story today, as our history as women. And even though it's not a Bible study, I find a couple of images really helpful for me in understanding where women have come from over the centuries. One of these is from, passages comes from Hebrews. The 11th chapter of Hebrews is kind of interesting. I won't read the whole thing, but it starts out about all those who died in the faith and what they've contributed. And it says, by faith, for instance, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of his sons. And by faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention. And it just goes through kind of a genealogy of history. By faith, all these people who came before us did these things, had this relationship with God. And then it concludes that section in chapter 12 saying, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. The image that comes to me there is that one of cloud of witnesses. And that's a little more pleasant image to me, that sense of being surrounded. To me, it gives something of a comforting sense of being part of a community, of people who have been and have gone in one sense and yet are still with us. It's an image that I find very useful and helpful to me. And the other image will be a little clearer perhaps at the end of our discussion, but it comes from 2 Corinthians in the 4th chapter, where it says, for what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For it is the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels to show that the transcendent power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed but not driven to despair, persecuted but not forsaken, struck down but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For while we live, we are always being given up to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. And I think the implications of that will become a little clearer too as we go along. We talk about our faith. How did we all come to be believers, those of us who are in this room? I don't know, have any of you been Christians by something other than birth, born into it? Have you? Everybody was born into Lutheran families? Well, that's part of our inheritance. There are lots of different journeys. I think even though we may all have been born into the same denomination of the same faith, each of us, if we were to tell our stories, would be able to say something about the journey that we've been on and how there have been specific points in that journey that has been critical for the development of our faith. There may have been times we felt distant or separated from our faith for legitimate reasons, and there may be other times that we suddenly have one of these light bulb experiences or whatever you use to define that, of a new understanding or a closeness or some radical change in our faith. And I think a lot of those things come about by virtue not only of our reading of scripture, but also by other people and the witness they make. So we talk about clouds of witnesses who surround us, or even the standing on the shoulders of giants, we realize that particular indebtedness. I started to research this a little bit about a couple of months ago. I was asked to do a Bible study for a group of ALC women, district conference, on the historical woman. And there was somebody doing the biblical woman, and somebody doing the historical woman, and somebody doing the contemporary woman. I thought, wow, you know, what is the historical woman? And I thought, you know, history is really long. I just finished reading Clan of the Cave Bear. I thought, that's history. You know, I thought that was a fascinating view of what it must have been like, could have been like, to be a woman, what we consider prehistoric times. And it seemed a little overwhelming to me. But as I started looking at it, defining what a historical woman was, I felt that it really encompassed both of the others. You know, a historical woman is somebody who is actively involved in the historical moment of her time, who participates as a human being, as a woman, who affects life. There's not a woman born who hasn't affected life in some way, other people or her environment. The historical woman could be my grandmother, is a historical woman, could be the woman that I was yesterday, or even the woman I am today. And I think if we look back at our own line of women that we come from, we realize that there is a certain indebtedness that we owe to a lot of them. As a pastor, I've become very much aware in the last few years of all the women that I owe so much to. When people ask me if it's been difficult being a woman and being a pastor, I say, well, some days it's really difficult. And it's hard to distinguish. It's difficult some days as being a pastor. Other days it's maybe difficult being a woman. And other days it seems it all kind of flows together. It's just fine. But for those times that it's not hard, for all those battles I don't fight, I've become increasingly aware of the great indebtedness I owe in history to numerous, innumerous women, innumerable, whatever the word is, countless women who have challenged, who've taken on the task of defining who they are in spite of what other people have told them they were or should be. One thing I just forgot to do, I realized, as I look at this microphone, is to say who I was and what we're doing. And maybe I'll just take this moment to introduce myself and just ask each of us to say who we are and where we're from, or in any particular concerns that you have or issues around this particular subject, and we'll see what happens. My name is Susan Berkelow. And this particular workshop is a workshop on history of women, or her story, and what it has to do with putting together a genealogy of our own, recollecting our own past. We've got the South and Southwest represented in here also. And one of the things I just like to do is just do some recollecting for ourselves on the women in history that we recall. I don't know if you have a great list at your disposal, but I do this not as an expert historian. I have a terrible memory, for one thing. I remember some amazingly insignificant things and forget some amazingly important things. But we have a lot of problems, I think, as we try to put together critical histories for ourselves. And I don't know, when you think about history, are there a lot of women that come to your mind, or do you find yourself having to search a little to remember? Just like in 60 seconds here, how many women do you think you could name in history that were important?
Very few.
Throw out a few names, just to get warmed up. Okay. We're probably better with our biblical women than we are with our other, between, there's 2,000 years between the Bible and now, and it's funny how that history seems so unimportant. It's not about being in the church that biblical history is really important, but you know, the centuries are just something you go through, and the present is sort of where it's at. Well, that's pretty good, though. That's a variety of... We started out, I noticed, with a few beheaded women. Yeah, it's got just how the list developed. And got into some women with power, like Cleopatra, and then some who excel in certain fields. I'm not content with that list. We're going to increase that list a little bit. I find I learn a lot this way too, depending on, our knowledge is a lot more than we know it is once we start delving within it. Why do you think it's so hard for us to remember women in history?
Partly because they're not taught in history books.
Yeah, they say we're all educated, you know, a fair amount in this country.
The assumption in all the history I ever studied was that it was only about men.
More about wars, which usually
men did.
Into the war, right.
Activities for men.
Right.
But they did.
History books were written by men.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most critical things. A lot I've learned about women has been in footnotes in books. And I'm also, it has to do with my remembering insignificant things. I look at footnotes and say, I'm going to explore that and check that out and find out. There's a whole book written on it somewhere. You can always find it someplace. But you have to look. You have to really search, and you have to want to know in order to find out. It's not something that's given to us as a gift as women, a heritage of the fact that we've been important in history as women. And it's true, women have suffered under very oppressive stereotyping since day one. If Clan of the Cave Bear is to be believed, it's been a part of that. There have been cultures in which the stereotypes have changed. They've not been perhaps as oppressive as in others. There's always some form of stereotyping as cultures tend to act out whatever relationships seem to work for them. But in general, women have suffered very much under this. And in the church, it's not been any exception. When I did this particular study, I wasn't focusing on biblical women because somebody else was doing that. And so I started pretty much with the early church. And what the women had received from that earlier study was an impression of women in the Bible as something very positive. Jesus' relationship with women was very positive and was very affirming, was very loving. And I can read about those stories of Jesus with women and feel good about my own relationship with God through that. And then I find out as I start reading the church fathers, and you start in seminary, you get hit with this right off. You start with the early history, and already women are wiped out because you're reading about the church fathers. We didn't read a whole lot about them, but later on I found a few quotes that I thought were really pertinent to women's history, why women perhaps have tended to be overlooked. This particular workshop should probably be X-rated or at least R-rated. I discovered in terms of violence to women. And I realized that violence to women, as looking at the video last night, violence to the spirit, I think violence to the spirit has been done to women along with physical violence, but perhaps more so than physical violence for a longer time. I think it has to do with how we value ourselves now, how each of us values other women or can relate or not relate to other women. I just wanted to quote some of the more offensive statements of the church fathers. This is not the core of their theology that made them famous, but it is something that is probably pervasive in their theology and somehow has gotten through to us in an unconscious way. We're dealing here with we can start with the Greek fathers. We go through Greek and Latin. And we're talking about between 150 and 500 AD. And this is Clement of Alexandria who says, "His beard then is the badge of a man and shows him unmistakably to be a man. He is old; it is older than Eve and is the symbol of the stronger nature. His characteristic is action, hers passivity. The male is hairier and more warm-blooded than the female, the uncastrated than the castrated, the mature than the immature." That was entitled In Praise of the Beard. Origen said, "What is seen with the eyes of the Creator is masculine and not feminine, for God does not stoop to look upon what is feminine and of the flesh." They had a big problem with menstruating women, too, I mean, in addition to women. And one particular rubric on that was, "The one who is not entirely pure in soul and body must be stopped from entering the Holy of Holies." There's also another of the Greek fathers who wrote, there were women functioning, teaching and preaching capacities at that time. And part of these writings were reactions against that. It's not that women have never done that, it's that it was oppressed and wiped out. There was a group which praised Mary as somebody who was worthy of honoring, and it was a group of men and women. And Epiphania said, "For the female sex is easily seduced, weak, and without much understanding. The devil seeks to vomit out this disorder through women. We wish to apply masculine reasoning and destroy the folly of these women. Here's one of my least favorite ones. John Chrysostom says, should you reflect about what is contained in beautiful eyes, in a straight nose, in a mouth, and in cheeks, you will see that bodily beauty is only a whitewashed tomb, for inside it is full of filth. He wrote that to a monk who was thinking of getting married. I know. That was the, we can go on to the Latin fathers. That was the Greek fathers. But you get a sense for, even though these may not be taught as the main tenets of their teaching, I think we're all aware of how our general feelings about other people also become incorporated in what we teach. The Latin fathers, just to tell you in advance, were not much better. Tertullian said, you are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him who the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image, man. He was talking to Christian women then about their dress. You have to admit, the in a sense, in an opposite way, the power that's given to women here in a very negative way, saying that women are stronger than the devil. The devil didn't succeed in tempting man, but woman did. It's placing women, you know, even below the utmost evil that was accepted at that time. And there's a couple more here. Says woman is inferior to man, for she is part of him, because the man is the origin of the woman. From that and on account of that, the woman is subject to the man, and she is under his command. The man is created in the image of God, but not the woman. I feel that nothing so casts down the manly mind from its height as the falling of a woman. Augustine, that's probably a good one to stop on. I don't know any woman who's read this, either in seminary or place else, that hasn't felt a real sense of indignation. You know, how could this be? And yet, as we ask ourselves, why is it that women were not ordained until the 20th century? I think that part of it comes from an understanding of the prevalence of those ideas and how ingrained they've been in our theology, the same theology that we've grown up in and been a part of. There's a whole dimension of our brain that we work out of that we're perhaps not that aware of. And there are a number of reasons. You know, I keep asking myself, how could the church go so wrong in 400 years or 200 years after Jesus that they would forget the modeling that he did of treating all people with respect? And there have been some explanations offered of this. One is just the society of the time was a very patriarchal society. The politics of the time dictated that there were certain ways of acting. A lot of the early women who were preaching and teaching received lots of criticism from the surrounding culture. They would point at the Christians and say, you let your women do that? And it says, well, you know, they're looking at us poorly. This is reflecting poorly on us for others. Therefore, we better stop these things that are giving us a bad image. And that was one of the reasons, I think, that women were put down that way. And the other reason, it was a very patriarchal society from just the culture, but also there were a lot of cults at that time. We talk now about the satanic cults. At those times, a lot of the cults were around women goddesses. And I think a lot of the Christian theologians felt they had to define themselves as different from those cults. And so they saw part of the way they could do that was saying, well, those have to do with women, we don't. And so women suffered under their form of distinguishing themselves from the pagan surroundings that they were reacting to. It's something that we all, I think, at different stages in our life, gain an awareness of how we view ourselves as women. And we find we have views of ourselves that we don't know where they come from. And we wonder how we came across these ideas. And I think there's sort of an unconscious history that becomes a part of us, that's carried with us and transmitted to us in ways we can't logically identify, but it's important for us to know that we probably carry pain with us from the past. We do carry with us an understanding of our role defined by centuries of both the religious institution and the cultural institution defining that. So So part of, one of the tasks I have is an ongoing task for myself, and especially this summer as I have some more time, is just to do some more reading and some sharing of stories with people. When I got to seminary, I was in Latin America for 5 years, from 73 to 78. And one of the things that happened while I was gone was a lot of the work in the feminist movement, inclusive language sort of came out of its hole from wherever it was hiding and became prevalent. I went to seminary, and I sat through some of these worship services, and they would read this red hymnal, and they automatically changed the word men to all, and they would, you know, add women here and there. And I was tripping all over my tongue, and I thought, you know, what happened here? Something has changed. And I was very embarrassed, having been a language major, that I had not invented this once I understood it. And I thought, you know, all I know the power of language. Why didn't I realize? But, you know, we can all say that. Why have we not realized earlier in life? Or, and those questions don't really take us anywhere. It's, you know, we start from where we're at. One of the things that really opened up the subject for me also was an art exhibit I saw in seminary. It wasn't at the seminary, it was at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. And I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's called The Dinner Party. You've seen it, or?
I've just
heard of it.
Heard of it more.
Has anybody seen it in the exhibit? It was really an amazing thing, and also helped place in perspective a lot of these things. What it is an exhibit put together initially by one woman who finally realized she needed help, by many women, and men also participated on the project. And it was set up as a way of honoring 36 women in history who had made a particular contribution. And the way they decided to do that was to do it in a traditional women's art form, and also with traditional women's contributions to society, which is through hospitality, the form of a dinner party, and through pottery and embroidery, which have been traditionally women's art. So there were 13 plate settings on this triangular table, and each plate was done in a specific way to honor a particular woman in history. And there was also an embroidered runner underneath of it, sort of as a placemat, that incorporated different styles of embroidery from the particular historical time as a way also of honoring what that woman's contribution was. I think when Judy Chicago put this together, started to do it, she realized that there were a whole lot of women that weren't going to fit in 36 place settings, and she felt bad about leaving them out. So she put tiles on the floor, and on the tiles she wrote the names of 999 other women who were worthy of remembering, but she didn't have enough plates and space to do that. They're from all countries, from all walks of life, beginning with the mythical and going up through contemporary times. And just an aside on the story, too, is that she's, I don't know where it's finally housed. I don't know if anybody knows. At the time it was being shown in San Francisco, they couldn't find a place that would show it as a regular exhibit because they said it wasn't art. It was women's crafts. And that didn't quite rank with art. And which was, and again, once more, an illustration of how contributions of women are kind of relegated to a place all of their own. You know, it's not really history. It's sort of the addendum there, the footnote. And it's not really art. It's this craft, women's work. Or it's not really philosophy. It's just women's writing. And there's been a lot of difficulty incorporating that into a whole of society. But as I looked at that, it was just a fascinating, I read it every so often. I have the books that describe this, and you know, you're welcome to look at these. They they have pictures of the plates in this book for each of the women. And then they have, do you have these books? Those of you who've seen this? It's a wonderful little encyclopedia about women in history. It has each woman that's written also on the floor and a little bit about her and who she is and her contribution throughout the centuries. And they're all quite varied in their designs. As people look at these, there's a lot of diverse reactions. Those of you who've seen it, have you heard negative reactions to this display besides the one I mentioned, that it wasn't really art?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with some overt sexuality and showing women's genitals in all these plates, is what I would say.
Right. Some are more obvious than others. The piano one wasn't too obvious, but others are more obvious. They consciously chose a sexual imagery, which is also the image of the butterfly. They combined those two images to as a way of depicting them as women, their contributions. That's been a criticism. And for some reason, I think from the early, that's another reason women were oppressed from the beginning, because the early church fathers seem to have been very uncomfortable with sexuality their own and others. And I've often quoted Augustine. He struggled so much, this poor guy. But that he had this prayer that said, Lord, please give me chastity, but not yet. You know, that sort of, yeah, he couldn't quite reconcile. And a lot of bad relationships with women were acted out, I think, in their theology, unfortunately. But that is part of it. What I thought it would be just interesting to do, and it's different with every group who does this, is try to put together a few more names than we've already mentioned of women. And I thought what we do is start with categories. Sometimes it helps if we just don't pick out of thin air, but if we look at different categories of women. For instance, if we've started with women who were philosophers or intellectuals or spiritual leaders of some sort, how many women could we name in that category? Who stands out in your mind? Anywhere from early primitive history through contemporary. This is always hard. I started with a really hard one. This is also the category that men seem to most jealously, you know, keep to themselves, and which makes it hard for us because women aren't thought to have intellect in a lot of areas of any repute.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, that's going back really early, right?
There's also a T-shirt staff over the right on woman.
Of Avila, right. Yeah, she was a very famous Spanish mystic. It was really, she was really felt confined by her womanhood. She's a very well-known woman. She wrote a lot of spiritual writings. She was a very good theologian. And she regretted that she was a woman because she knew what she could do if she were a man. She regretted that. I don't think she was regretting her womanhood as much as she was the fact that she felt confined and knew what that lack of freedom meant to her. And she's become much more widely read recently also. I think the Orders of St. Martin and Teresa, isn't she one that they include in the Teresas? One of the stories that I picked up in a footnote, this is the one I remember, is the story of Heloise and Abelard. Have you heard of Heloise? I guess I pick up some strange stories too. She was a very intelligent young woman, and Abelard was a man who was assigned to be her tutor. And they got along very well, and they fell in love and decided they wanted to get married. And they snuck out one day and got married. I mean, we're talking, I think, the 12th century, literally. They got married, and they kept it a secret. And Abelard arranged for Heloise to be able to go to a convent. And somewhere along the way, her father found out that she was pregnant and thought that Abelard had abandoned her. And he sent some people out to get Abelard. They castrated him and, you know, generally left him barely living. But he survived that, and he went on to a monastery where he was the head of this monastery. And Heloise went on to become the abbess of this convent where she was and established others also, and became one of the foremost thinkers and writers of her day. And her letters to Abelard during that period are very famous. And one of the reasons that, you know, I just think of that is just the tragedies that were involved among women when they attempted to become who they could be and how that was interpreted by society, and yet the contributions that were made still through that. Is something that's certainly notable. She's one of the ones that's most well known, I think, among theologians. Any other spiritual leaders? Okay, yeah, Anne Hutchinson, early American history. Right, in the early parts of American history. There have been a lot of women that have worked in theology in the United States. Mary Baker Eddy, I never agreed with her. You can't deny that she was a woman who began a whole church. Also in the 19th century, a lot of the women were the revivalists.
I think we've had a great women missionary
whose story is
not very well known.
Okay, yeah, right. One woman recently, too, who's been, who was very notable working in Ecuador. Have you heard of Jan Gallagher? The Inca Ecuador things that you sell here come from her work in Ecuador. She worked with poor people there for a number of years and developed the craft and provided outlets in this country to sell them. But she died a month ago in a motorcycle accident. And, was, you know, very much mourned by a number of people who so respected her ministry there. remember.
One of our friends and heroines is Marjorie Lawrence. She's a missionary nurse among lepers on an island off of Taiwan.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to the next category. This is an easier category. Healers. How about women in healing professions? Who do you think of them?
Florence
Nightingale. Florence Nightingale, right.
Well, the witches in the early 19th century were mostly healers. Mm-hmm. Most of them were skilled for their pain. The witches, the black, the good working
Yes, the first woman killed for witchcraft was Margaret Jones, and she was a physician practitioner. And the way the story goes, she was killed by because of the jealousy of her male counterparts. They could not tolerate her for working in that. And that was some new information that I had recently, too, of how many of the witches were women who were working in healing arts, which have this connotation, if you're good at it, you know, they look at you like you have some other power. You know, if you can do this and we can't, if it's a woman,
yeah,
it's obviously somebody else is helping you. Right, yeah, it was ascribed to negative rather than positive power.
Plus the witches gave some gave women some autonomy over their bodies because of abortion. They did verbal abortion. They knew what berries and herbs so they could help people with a lot of aspects of their reproduction. Childbearing, child conceiving, pregnancy, and abortion.
Which is very threatening.
Right.
It's interesting that of all the medical fields, gynecology and obstetrics were the hardest for women to get into. For some reason, you know, who was the first woman physician to graduate in the United States? Elizabeth Blackwell. I think there were other women that went to medical school. Usually they had to disguise themselves as men. And what's really remarkable, I heard she refused to do that. She applied to medical school and the dean of the school apparently opened it up to the students, all males, whether they should let her in or not. And they said as a joke, sure, why not, we'll let her in, and which was the beginning of her grief, as we can probably imagine. And she went through, graduated with honors, went on to graduate studies in Europe with her sister, and another woman opened the first hospital for women and children in this country. And did some remarkable things, but she talks about how hard it was to get into the fields of obstetrics and gynecology. Which is really strange too. It's, I suppose if we analyze that, we could look at what that means in terms of power and independence. When I was in seminary, there were 11 of us women who met one evening for dinner, and we were just, you know, checking each other out, and we discovered in the process of talking that of the 11 of us, 8 of us had mothers who were nurses. One of us was a nurse, and one had a sister who was a nurse, and a father was a doctor. And we thought, you know, there must be something really significant to this fact, and we weren't sure what it was, but, you know, as you analyze it, you can sort of sift out some of the things, perhaps, that the main professions for women have been nursing or teaching, so the odds are stacked that it'll be one of those two. But I think also there's something about, traditionally, healing has been a part of the church's ministry. It's not been separated. Those two have been seen as ministry. And it's only in modern scientific times that we tend to separate them and say this belongs in this category and that belongs in the other.
Although in American history, in the doctrine, it's sort of a graph you can do where there's low respect and low pain, and it's mostly women, and then if it got to be higher respect and higher pain, it got to be almost all men.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came into it some kind of a thing that doctors are gods. We give to doctors the power over our body, we turn to them to save us, we assume that they have mystical knowledge about us. We sort of go, who else did you go to? And take off all your clothes and lie on a table.
And not many.
How many people?
In the African proverb, it says, you educate a woman and you educate a family. other thing about Carolyn Herschel, she was educated sort of under wraps. Her mother didn't want her to be educated, thought it would make her too restless. So her father secretly gave her education as she was growing up. A lot of women received education that way and went on to teach others too. Throughout history in the convents, a lot of teaching went on that couldn't go on anyplace else. Yes, very famous. Right. How about artists? Mm-hmm. Writers, painters, musicians. Mm-hmm. Probably a little more knowledgeable in that area. Also, I think of the women blues singers, early part of the century. You know, you hear about the big bands and who led the bands, and almost all of them had one woman who was particularly important as a singer to that group. So a lot of women are now also doing more about women's music and bringing that out as well. A lot of poetry. We heard one poem read the other day, Threatened with Resurrection, that was read in the service on Sundays by a Guatemalan poet named Julia Esquivel, who's a social activist, poet, and teacher, and many other things. So how about women in areas of service? Oh, yeah. Jane Addams?
By the way,
women are multi talented often, yes.
The women are the ones who are doing the same thing. The men have to stay in after 7 o'clock. The women can go out and be free.
And then all the police demands and say, wasn't that a good idea after? Everyone could go out.
It's amazing how one solution can be twisted around. I think some of those women are women also you'd include, just not politics, women who fought for equality, which is even broader than politics. Women who fought against slavery, against inequalities for others as well as for themselves. And I think also women who fought for peace and justice in a very special sense, who weren't necessarily politically involved. And on Mother's Day, I always remember all these women. Because in a sense, I feel them sort of as mothers, in a way, spiritual mothers or historical mothers or whatever. I think the Irish women, the Protestant and Catholic, who dare to say, hey, you know, we're together, we should not be fighting each other, we should not be killing each other, to stand out in the midst of all that and stand up for something different, which takes courage to let go of those loyalties that lead to death and to affirm those that bring life. I admire them very much. I also admire the women in Latin America. I think I saw a movie not long ago on the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina. You may have heard of them during a long period of repression in Argentina. Just thousands and thousands of young people disappeared because of their ideological convictions. They're working in communities of poor people. And I remember in this movie, they interviewed a lot of these mothers. And one of the mothers said of the lesson, she'd lost two sons and a daughter in their 20s during this time and didn't know where they were, but she said she learned from her daughter to love a group of people that she'd always ignored before. From her own middle class perspective, she'd ignored a whole series of marginal peoples that were part of her society. And she said, in a sense, in recent time, my daughter has become my mother, and I've learned through her to love. And there's something about that whole sense of history that is cyclical for us in our learnings and how they take place. And the comadres, the mothers of the disappeared in El Salvador, who stand out there and make themselves visible and open to oppression to be able to denounce what is hurting everybody for the life of their children, which is really the life of the whole country. I want to share a poem with you too. This poem was written by a man, but I thought it was a wonderful poem, and it was written after he visited this group of mothers of the disappeared in El Salvador. It's Pastor Jerry Swanson, who's been chaplain at California Lutheran University in Thousand Oaks. One of the women who shared with this group that was visiting was named Carmen Campos, and she was somebody who had lost, I don't know how many children, 5 children or so. They had cut off one of her breasts. They had shot her. She had 5. She showed them her bullet holes, and I mean, there's somebody who does show her body to people for the purpose of sharing what was happening. And he was very touched by this witness of hers, and so he wrote this poem.
the Carmen Campos, mother of sorrows, mother of hope, mother of the disappeared, the assassinated, and the imprisoned, mother of El Salvador. You bring me to new life from your riddled womb. You nurse me from your one breast with the milk of courage. Newborn I am, newly empowered by the laying on of mothering hands. Carmen Campos, mother of sorrows, mother of hope. I think there are many nameless women. Doesn't matter, we can't name them all, because there are many nameless women who are forerunners for us, who are mothers, who are models, who are sisters, who are survivors. Sometimes your only claim to fame is that you survived, and that I don't diminish survival at all these days. We think achievement is great, but for some people, to survive is the supreme example of courage and whatever you have that enables you to do that. But I think the important lesson comes from this for all of us, and each of us has the task in our own level to make connections. How am I connected with those women? Might say I owe a debt to many women who come before me. I owe debt to many women who are not necessarily Christian, because being a woman is part of who I am, and all have contributed to a part of our history that enables each of us to be who we are as women, as Christians, as wherever we're from, as whatever we do. And I think there's a real temptation for people to divide us. I've heard with the new church coming in, there's one of the things that's under attack is the quotas. And the LCA bishops think that quotas aren't good. And I heard a woman talk about this recently, saying that, you know, quotas, saying 10%, a goal of 10% minority people in national commissions, and 50% women, and 50% lay and clergy is what we have. And as we think about that, somebody has a sneaky suspicion, some really cynical person is thinking that when it comes down to the voting, what they're going to say is, well, we'll leave the quota 50% for women, but we won't keep the quota 10% for people of color. And I think I find in that kind of political maneuvering, both in the church or elsewhere, a real challenge for women to maintain the connectedness that we have. And I think there's something there that we don't always define that's really important for us to look for. And I noticed that when I went to the church I was at in L.A., the Nestle boycott was still on. And a couple of the men came up to me and they said, the women are really into this Nestle boycott thing. And, you know, I think it's kind of dumb, but, you know, they do it. They let them do it. And then I talked to the women and they said, this is important stuff. This Nestle boycott is important. And even without being able to articulate why, one of the things that I think came was the fact that they identified with the common experience of women across boundaries. They identified with what Charlie Clemens said, or the Salvadoran refugee said, the violence of watching your child die from malnutrition. Even though they don't speak Spanish and don't know any South American women, perhaps, they could identify with those common experiences. And it really radicalized the LCW. They were among the strongest supporters of this Nestle boycott, and they don't jump on any boycott wagon. But I think it had to do with being women and having a strong sense of identification with that. And we do have separations among us. We call women the fourth world. We talk first, second, and third world, which are basically some cultural economic distinctions. But if you talk fourth world, you're talking about a whole different group that covers every class, that covers every culture, that covers every race. And we're subject to the same divisions that divide our society. And one of the things I really enjoy working with women, I enjoy being with women, because I find in that common, the commonness that is there, that's so much greater, both historically and contemporarily, the possibility to break through some of the barriers that up until now have kept us both as countries at war and as individuals separated and as churches divided. And I think we just need to name those and respond. And what barriers would you say are the ones that are the greatest ones that divide women, that keep us from bonding and being a cohesive force, say like the Irish women who just broke through the conflict and bonded themselves as a force? What are the things that divide us still? Pardon? Okay. Yeah, that model that, you know, somebody has to be on top, and if I don't try, I might be down below. But,
Okay.
Three-fifths of the women in poverty, three-fifths of the people in poverty now are women and children. They say by the year 2000 will be almost all poverty people will be women and children. 80% of the refugees that come from Latin America are women and children. It used to be men who'd come and get jobs and send money home, but now it's reversed and it's a different type of economics. That would be one that does that, classism. In fact, we're divided into different economic stands. I noticed in Chile, women felt they were very free, and there was a definite class system there. And the women who felt very free to be professionals, doctors and lawyers, were often women who had money and could employ other women to work in their home to do the things. So they never really challenged those roles that we were talking about last night of men and women, who does the housework and everything. It was still the woman's job. She just was able to employ somebody to cover that aspect of her life while she did other things, and the men still did their own traditional things. So I think that the forms of class and money really divide us still and keep that bonding from happening.
Age, too. Mm-hmm. Age has to do with beauty, too. Our culture deals with how it's appropriate to look.
Mm-hmm. And how that changes part of the competition aspect. Mm-hmm. Setting them to compete one against another, using attractiveness as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And to achieve whatever, to narrow fashion success in business world by using quote unquote feminine wiles.
Yeah. Yeah, youth is better than age, and
mm-hmm.
and if you're good looking, you will succeed.
Right.
What do you think historically about the role violence has played? I think violence still controls us. We fear violence, the potential
mm-hmm.
for violence against us. And I think that men use violence historically. It's rooted, obviously, very deep in our history.
Mm-hmm.
The threat of them being able to force us to have sex, to kill us, to push us around, to force us physically, to go to physically. I think that's a very fundamental thing in this historical view of how we behave now.
Mm-hmm.
I think
it's
one
to be this. Mm-hmm. Is there going to be like,
yeah,
in both sides? You know, Dracula and Dracula.
God's will for women to be in a certain acceptance. Yeah, I think it comes in a lot of forms, just intimidation. I was talking with a friend of my mother's when I was in seminary, a woman I'd known for a few years, and all of a sudden she said how good it was to talk to me and how pleased she was that she wasn't intimidated by me as she was by her pastor and her doctor. I was the same person I had been a couple of years ago, except I was in seminary. The thought that, you know, I would be sitting there intimidating this woman was, you know, really amazing to me. But it was that projecting of, I'm intimidated by pastors and you're going to be a pastor. How strange, I'm not intimidated by you or my doctor. You know, but those authority figures that I mentioned earlier about the power that they have that we ascribe to
but
those,
you know,
roles.
When I think about that, I try to think back one step further and I think what created that terror and violence in men.
Mm.
And I think, and this may be discussed earlier, really, but when I think of women, I think of the villain. I think that deep dark power that is around here, that my men are just terrified,
mm-hmm.
that it has to do with giving birth, it has to do with magic, it has to do with females, the powers in nature. And I often have the sense that there's something very deep that men are terrified of in women that is set off their violence against us. I mean, like, I see the circle. I don't
sure.
see men being violent against women and women being victims. I see that women kind of recognize the power that takes place in the very their bodies.
Well, it's been said the one thing oppressors and victims have in common is fear, you know, the fear of each other, and it sets off these patterns. And yeah, you know, we mentioned a little bit about that witchcraft and the power that comes from that sort of healing thing. And Rosemary Ruther, I think, has said, too, something about the priestly functions are so suited for women, the serving at the table and the nurturing, and, you know, there are things that come very naturally to women, and that she suspects that men are afraid of how natural that comes to women. And the excuse that's been given is that women are subordinate, therefore they cannot manifest the supremacy of the priesthood. And as long as women are kept subordinate, that argument could hold, if you buy that argument. But yeah, it's a way of controlling that And it's a cycle of violence too, because it's sort of like the Latin American thing. If you're a victim constantly, it does help your identity. Another thing I think every woman has in common, I don't care, you know, whether she works at home or has another profession or whatever, is this deep sense of self-doubt that, you know, the most accomplished woman in the world, you just scratch a little below the surface and think, oh my, where does she get those feelings of doubt? And I think there's something about our history that has instilled those in us that make us, it's a sexism that turned in towards us. And I remember once I went to a counselor, and I, you know, this is my new enlightened state, I was going to find a woman counselor because I wanted to, I thought that was best for me. And I only talked to her on the phone. I went to see her the first hour. The first hour was worth the money, I think. I went in to see her, and I was shocked when I saw her because she was so short, and she was so soft-spoken. I thought she'd be very good with kids. And she was very pretty and very gentle. And I suddenly, she was shorter than I was, I mean, I'm not that tall, but I suddenly had this feeling of power. You know, I thought, I'm going to walk all over this woman. You know, she's not going to be able to help me with anything. And, you know, this was fleeting through my mind, you know, and I reflected on this later when I went home. We spent an hour talking, and I realized at the end of the hour she would not let me walk over her. And as I thought what was going on in my mind, I thought, never in my right mind would I say that a woman would not be competent. But I realized that, yes, a woman can be short, can be pretty, can be soft-spoken, can be gentle, and can be competent. You know, somewhere deep inside of me, there was something saying that no, that's not possible. And I was just shocked at my own, you know, incorporating that into myself. I thought, what else do I have hidden in there that works against me as I try to be who I really can be or who I really am? And I think we need to explore that together to find out, you know, what comes to us, and oh, we're done. And I just, a couple other things I wanted to say, just going back to that first, the first quotes from the fathers of the church, early fathers, I think they were right in a lot of ways. I think it's true. Women are earthy. Women are very much earthbound. I think women are very grounded, just physically. We're built to be grounded. You know, our center of gravity is lower. We talk about Mother Earth, the connection with fertility. There's power in fertility. You know, men, I know a lot of men who are really jealous of women because they cannot bear children. And, you know, that they don't, not many men will express that. I think more may feel that. Women are nurturing. And I think very much of ourselves as earthen vessels in a very graphic sense of the word. And that's why the Corinthians text, I think, is so important. They were right about all those things about women, but what they were wrong about, which is critical, is the fact that it was good. You know, God created us this way, and God created us good. And so to be a woman is good. And Jesus became human to show, I mean, that was a great honor that Jesus did the incarnation, I mean, the incarnation honored our earthly existence. It showed us where God is found, showed us where God finds us in our earthly lives. And somehow I think women have a task, which has not been ever appreciated, of reminding men of this.